So tonight, we're going to talk about the Four Noble Truths of Love. I didn't choose the topic. Well, I'll try my best. Can I know in the room who has been to any Buddhist class? I just want to know who hasn't learned any of Buddhist teachings in this class. Just one? So majority of you have sort of idea what the Buddha's teachings about, okay? So if you don't understand, if I'm speaking too fast, just let me know, because I tend to speak really fast sometimes. So just put your hand up and just ask me questions. I'll try my best. So since most of you have known the Buddha's teachings, I will just briefly probably touch on the basic stuff, but I will cover them again for the sake of everyone in the room. So basically, I believe most of you are not well aware or know what the Four Noble Truths are. Right? Yes? No? Yeah. Okay. Four Noble Truths. So it's one of the core teachings in Buddhism. In fact, that's the first teaching the Buddha taught to his first disciples. So once when the Buddha was practicing meditation and he became enlightened, and then when he decided to teach, the first teaching that he gave to his first disciples, there were five of them, is the Four Noble Truths. They are called Noble Truths because essentially they are the reality, the truth that we can't dispute in a way. They are called noble because my interpretation is because somebody who has gone through enlightenment and all those sort of things that can understand the truth itself. So it's kind of, in a way, it's quite noble in a way. The Pali word for that is Ariyan. Ariyan is also used to acknowledge somebody who is enlightened. So it's the same word. So essentially, how I see it is that somebody who has seen the truth essentially are people who are enlightened. So for most of us, I believe, well, I'm not, are still in the path to understand the truth. So it's okay if we haven't completely comprehend the truth, it's fine because it's part of the path. So what are the Four Noble Truths? Well, I'm thinking of covering the Four Noble Truths as much as I can before we touch on the main topic, which is love. Well, that's quite an interesting topic. But anyway, the Four Noble Truths are essentially, the first one is the truth of suffering. And then the second truth is the cause of suffering. And then the third one is the cessation of suffering. And the fourth one is the path. So suffering in itself is... the word that the Buddha used is dukkha, D-U-K-K-H-A, dukkha. So the word dukkha, it's very hard to find an equivalent English word to interpret dukkha, because dukkha essentially is, the common translation to dukkha is suffering, but it's not really suffering. Dukkha is not just about suffering, but dukkha is about imperfection itself. Because it's imperfect, therefore it's unsatisfactoriness. So dukkha can be translated as unsatisfactoriness. In essence, nothing in life is satisfactory. There's always an aspect of it that is unsatisfactory. The reason why is because of the fact that everything in life is impermanent. Whether you like it or not, things will change. It's not up to us to decide when things change and how things change. Things happen because of its causes and conditions. Some causes and some conditions are beyond our own control. Therefore, we can't control how things happen a lot of time. We think that we do. We think that we are in control, but essentially we are not in control. I give you an example. Are you in full control of how your body processes the cells in the body, how your heart beat, and how whether you're going to sweat, or whether, is it up to you? If it's really up to you, then you have a full control of it. The fact that it's not really up to you, you don't have full control. Yes, you can influence it. In a way, you can make yourself a bit cooler when you sweat a lot. Like you can fan yourself or go to a cooler room to control the condition. But essentially, it's not up to you when you're going to stop sweating. Right? If it's up to you, then you can say, I'm the owner. But because I don't own the body, we don't own the body, we can't tell this body how it's going to function. We can influence in a way that help the body to feel comfortable, to help the body to be at its best, but essentially we can't decide how it's going to turn out. Similarly with sickness, it's not up to us when we're going to get better, it's not up to us when we're going to get sick. Well, if it's up to us, I don't think anyone want to get sick. I don't want to get sick. So it's not really up to us, is it? The bacteria, the virus are in the environment. They are around. But it's not really up to us to say to the bacteria, don't attack me, stay away from me. We can't do that. So essentially, because of that, life in essence is not satisfactory. Because something that you don't like will happen. Everybody don't like to feel sick. Everybody don't like to grow older, old. And nobody likes to feel the pain in the body. But these things happen. We like it or not, these things happen. That's why the Buddha say, life is dukkha. Because a lot of things in life, not in your control, and suffering. But the cause, interestingly, the cause of suffering is not life. Because if you think about it, if life is impermanent, if life is imperfect, right? Why didn't the Buddha say life in itself is the problem? But the Buddha didn't say the life in itself is a problem. The problem lies within ourselves. It's not it doesn't lie outside of ourselves. It lies within ourselves. It's how we relate to life. It's the clinging, it's the attachment that we have that is the cause of our suffering. And suffering in this, what the Buddha said, wasn't the suffering of this physical body, but rather the optional suffering, whether how we react to things that life throws at us. Excuse me. So the mental suffering is the one the Buddha is talking about in here. The cause to the mental suffering in life is our own attachment or clinging. But then it's not really just a depressing story. The Buddha said there is a cessation to this. There is a way out. And he even laid the path for us to practice how to get ourselves out of this cycle of suffering, which is the Noble Eightfold Path, which can be summarized into a practice of sila, morality, samadhi, meditation, and panya, wisdom. So there are eight, can be categorized into three baskets. So that is Four Noble Truth, which is quite straightforward, don't you think? Well, it is and it is not. It is in theory. It is not when you apply them into practice, because life is quite complicated and simple at the same time. Anyway, so love. Why is love suffering? Because when I got the blurb, it says the Four Noble Truths of Love, and then a short description of it to say that love is causing suffering. Is that so? Put your hand up if you have experienced the suffering of love. Oh, wow. good. Why? Why do you find it suffering? Huh? Yeah. Share. Huh?
Attachment.
Attachment? Cannot let go. That's good. Attachment, cannot let go. And anything else? Anything to add?
Because we were blinded.
We are what?
Blinded by love.
Blinded. I like that. That is so true. It's suffering is because we don't have the wisdom to see things clearly. That's basically it. The essence of it, whether it's love, whether whatever other feelings that you have, why we feel suffering is basically so simple. It's because we don't see things as they truly are. We don't have the wisdom. We lack the wisdom. That's why we suffer. It doesn't matter whether the feeling that you've experienced is love, whether you're feeling what? Disappointment, or whether you're feeling joy. Joy in itself can be a suffering. If you don't have the wisdom to relate to the experience, you'll feel suffering, whether it's a good experience or bad experience. Because love in itself is not a very bad experience, isn't it? Like, there is a love between parents and children. And this kind of love is beautiful, and it's somehow essential. Because without love, we won't survive. Right? You won't be standing here, you won't be in Australia, you won't be in this room without the love from your parents. So love is quite important. And I doubt anyone can not feel a feeling of love. As long as you have an open heart, you'll feel some level of love in your life. Maybe some people have more, some people have less. But we are bound, like we are conditioned to have this feeling. What I'm trying to say is that it's natural to feel love. As a human being, it's natural. And that's not a problem. Right? When you feel something, when you feel liking, what reaction do you normally get? When you like something, what do you...
Happy?
What else?
You crave for it.
You want more of it, don't you? Right? You want more of it. So basically, when you have feeling, if it's a liking feeling, you want more. If it's a disliking feeling, something that you don't like, what's your reaction going to be? You want to push it away. So the one that want more, the one that want push away, is basically driven by craving. It's the craving that makes you want to push away or want more. And then because of that, when you, and also clinging. So after you feel something, you want more, and or you want to push it away, that's driven by your craving, and then you cling to it. You cling, and that the clinging itself is very much that what causes you pain, really. The one that causes you pain is the craving and the clinging to things, no matter what it is. It can be your possession. It can be what you have. It can be your happiness. It can be even your suffering. Believe it or not, some people cling to their suffering. I don't know if you have a tendency to become melancholic. I sometimes do. And I notice in my mind that I sometimes cling to this emotion. Cling to the feeling of down, feeling melancholic, feeling unloved in a way. There is a clinging in the mind. Sometimes we're not aware of it, but if you're aware of it, there is that sort of energy in the mind that wants it to stay. That's what clinging does. It wants it to stay. So if the path of practice is not really to not have the feeling, don't get me wrong. Feeling sometimes is inevitable. You naturally will like something, you naturally will dislike something. But where the practice lies is not to deny this feeling, but rather to welcome them and then see them as your teachers. Because they can teach you a lot. They teach you a lot how you tick. Sometimes we react habitually without really realizing that that's how I react, if that makes sense. And when you pause and when you step back and you watch your mind, that's when you can see how you tick. If you know how you tick, then it's easier to help yourself to get yourself out of trouble. That's also how you can learn or grow your own wisdom, by understanding yourself and how yourself work. That helps you to increase your wisdom. By understanding yourself too, you can understand how others work. Because your mind and my mind is no different. If I understand how my minds tick, then I can understand how your mind ticks. If I understand how your mind ticks, I probably have better understanding how to help you if you're in trouble. A lot of conflicts in relationships is because of this lack of understanding. It's not that we don't want to help each other, but sometimes we just don't know what's the right way or what's the best way. And why we don't know? Because we don't have the understanding. We don't have good level of understanding to help in a way, which is fine. And through trial and error, sometimes we find out and we figure out things. And it's fine to make mistakes too. The intention matters more than the action itself, how I see it. Because if you have intention to help, but you're scared of making mistakes, it's not even helpful. Because maybe what you have in mind might be helpful too. Maybe. If you don't give it a go, you don't know. So it's okay if you're unsure, but as long as you have a good heart, good intention, you can try act on it and see how it reacts. If it's not helpful, then try another way. That's how I see it. When I got the topic of love, I'm more inclined talking about relationship rather than just love itself, because love is part of it, where relationship is the bigger picture. When I'm talking about relationship, it's not just the partner, girlfriend, boyfriend relationship, wife, husband relationship, but it's a relationship with everyone. Can be a relationship with your parents, your friends, your siblings, and the most important one is relationship to yourself. Because if you know, or if we have better understanding how we relate, it helps us in our life. It helps us reduce our suffering. So how I see it is, sometimes we are probably a condition to think about, you know, when we talk, when we see movies or we read articles, if we want to touch on, let's say I'm talking about romantic relationship right now, they talk a lot about the one. And when you frame things like this, it somehow conditions oneself to think that there is a right person in there. Like there has to be a right match. So it's about the other person. What I'm trying to change the way we see is not about the other person, but rather it's about the between me and the other person. It makes sense? So it's not so much about A, B, or C, or D, or the person that I'm talking to, but it's more about the space between me and A and B, or the other person that I'm talking to. What do I mean by the space, right? The space is in itself is that what you put in there. How do you relate to this person? What sort of attitude you have towards this person? When you relate, when you interact with this person, what sort of attitude you have? What intention do you carry in your heart when you have this relationship with this person? That's to me is more important than the person. Because you will always be able to find fault in anyone. I can guarantee there is nobody in this world will be faultless. There's always something that you can find fault in anyone. No matter they are Mother Teresa or somebody who has such a great heart, you can always find a mistake in them. Right? So if why I'm saying that is because if we focus so much about the other person, we will try, keep trying to find a better person to be our friend, to be our partner, to be, and we try to change the other person to make them be the better person in our mind. But by doing that, it's not a wise thing, because you're putting your focus at the wrong place. That's not the right focus. The focus should be what do you put in between in your relationship. So the Buddha encouraged us to practice. My view is that what should be in between is these four qualities of mind that the Buddha encouraged us to practice. They are basically the Brahma Viharas. Probably some of you have had guessed that. So the first one is metta, or loving kindness. And then the second one is compassion, or karuna. And the third one is sympathetic joy, or mudita. And the fourth one, equanimity. So to practice or to make ourselves have better relationship, I think we should always put in the forefront in our back of our mind to try our best to put more of these qualities. So the first one is metta, loving kindness. What is it? It's basically a well-wishing towards another person. A wish for the other person to be well, a wish for the other person to be happy. Metta in itself can be translated as friend. So sometimes they say it's a friendliness, loving kindness, because it has a quality of love. The Buddha gave a simile. Metta quality is like a mother who loves her only child, who is willing to sacrifice her life for this child. So that's the quality of metta. Metta embodies a quality of indiscriminative and unconditional love to all beings. So it's a very expansive quality, not the kind of romantic relationship, romantic love where it's only focused to one particular individual. Metta is all-encompassing. So you broaden the scope of your love, not by particular individual, but rather for as many beings as possible. That's a quality of metta. And then quality of karuna or compassion is to feel the suffering of others. But a lot of times people confused that when you feel compassion, you have to suffer. I think to suffer, it's not productive. Rather, the quality of compassion is more like you have the empathy to feel how the other person suffer, yet you have the intention, the drive to help this person. Because you feel for this other person suffering, therefore you want to help them out. So that's a quality of compassion. There's a strong force within you to relieve their suffering. That's karuna. And mudita is you rejoicing another person's happiness. And mudita, I don't know about you, but to me, I think the hardest, well, except equanimity, I think equanimity is a bit higher level, but out of three, I think mudita to me is the harder one, because maybe partly also conditioning, partly because I'm more competitive in nature, so I like to be better than other person. So conditioning wise, it's harder to feel the joy when somebody is more successful. But I can tell you, this is one of the best quality that you can have, because it's a win-win. If you think about it, it's a win-win. When you feel joy because another person is feeling happiness or be more successful than you, it's a win for you as well if you can be happy for them. Because what's the alternative? The alternative is you feel depressed, you feel low. So mudita is win-win. It's like no-brainer, right? But why is it so hard? It's hard because of the ego, the sense of self who wants more, who wants to be better. But then if you can let go of that and be happy genuinely for the other person, the taste is really nice. It's such a nice feeling. It's very liberating at the same time. It's liberating because you're letting go of the ego. So I will encourage you to try to practice that. But I think most of you are pretty good with it anyway. Like, really good with it. So I don't think has a lot of problem with that. The last one is equanimity. I think it's put the last, it's also nicely put in there, because imagine if you have the well-wishing for the other person is trying, and the other person is suffering, you want to help them, and then you try your best to help them, but then sometimes you just can't. Because either they are not ready, the conditions are not right, you just can't help. It's not the right time yet. And then that's when you have to bring up this quality of upekkha or equanimity. It means letting go of, how I see it, is upekkha is a quality of mind when you can let go, when you are at peace with whatever. Whatever that happens, you're at peace. Whether that thing that happens to you is something that you wish to happen, you're at peace. Whether that thing that happens is not something that you expect, you're also at peace. That is the quality of upekkha. It's a very calming, very cooling kind of state of mind where you are at ease with anything. It's not a dispassion, it's not something that is aloof where you are detached to the situation. It's not. It's actually, you're in the situation. When you're feeling this upekkha, you're in it. But at the same time, you're not affected by it. You're always having this peaceful state of mind. That's upekkha. And that's the ultimate. That's the ultimate. If we can practice that as much as we can, then it's good. If we can't, then we keep trying. And then, coming back to the Four Noble Truths, as I said, we can't help but feel. We can't help to live in an imperfect world. Conditions are never perfect. Things will always go wrong. Things will never always be on your term. Some days they're just out of whack, right? But that's okay. Let's take that as part of our practice. Let's take that as our teachers. Don't judge yourself if you're not performing the way you want you to perform. What I'm trying to say is sometimes we beat over ourselves when we think that we should not behave in a certain way, yet we behave in another way. So rather than reacting to that thing by beating ourselves, might as well take it as a lesson. As a lesson to learn and how we can be better next time. And the key of all this is the path itself. If you can integrate the path into your daily life, that's even better. Because essentially that's the solution to the problem. Because no matter what, I can guarantee this to you, no matter how hard you try, life will always throw something at you that you don't like. No matter how much you try, no matter how much you keep your life in a way that in a certain order, certain ways, there's always something that will be happening outside of what you want. That's 100%. I can put my money on it. It will happen. So don't try to make life happen the way you want it, but rather try to dance with whatever life gives you. Dance with life. Dance with the ups and downs. Accept things the way they are. But acceptance doesn't mean that you don't proactively change things. It means that you don't reject what is happening. You welcome all experiences that happens to you, be good or bad, and then learn from it. Do you have any question?
Rossi, you mentioned about Descartes being like always in the middle, but isn't it kind of like contradicting to, like, say being like joy when the others are being successful in some of it? So, like, which one are you really in your line? Like,
I try to understand your question, but let me try. So, upekkha is, how it translated is the equanimity, is as a balanced state of mind. It doesn't mean that you don't feel anything. You actually feel something. The feeling is actually, if I want to put a word...
Hi, Auntie.
Thank you. The feeling is actually a feeling of peace. Feeling of peace, if you have a taste of peace, it's actually more refined than joy, right? It's more refined. So upekkha usually is more refined kind of quality. That's why it puts the last, I think. And also it's when you practice meditation, it reaches to the later state in your meditation as well, because it's a very refined level of mental state. But the daily thing that I can think of with upekkha is to be able to be at peace or at ease with things. When you're at ease with things, surprisingly, you also feel happy. But the happiness is quite refined. It's not a happiness that excites you, but it's a calming kind of happiness. It's a different types of happiness. You know, when you're excited, you have peak energy, right? But this kind of happiness is more like very calming. If you see the lake, that kind of calm. When the joy or excitement is more like a wave in the ocean, you've got a big wave and it will go down. So, but with calming happiness, it's like the lake. The water still flow, yet the lake is still and calm. Whereas the other one, you have the peak and you have the low. So you have the... That's why it's more refined in a way, because you don't have extreme up and extreme down, but rather you have quite constant, yet peaceful and calm. Yet it's very... It's hard to describe, but it's very pleasant. That's what I'm trying to say. It's very pleasant feeling. That's why it's a kind of happiness. It's the happiness because it's quite pleasant. It's very cooling, it's very calming. That's upekkha, how I interpret it. I don't know if it makes sense.
Thank you. Oh, it's okay.
You sure? You want to add on?
Just adding on probably.
Yeah.
In the Abhidhamma Buddhism, so it's like a kind of a more, kind of, what do you call that? It's a book of Buddhism, basically. So it's probably a more presented by the Theravada point of view. But basically, joy and equanimity, the consciousness that arises with joy is a different consciousness that arises with equanimity. So they arise at two different times. So when there's joy, there's no equanimity there, but then there's no equanimity there, that's no joy. It's like two different moments. It can arise at like really successive.
Yeah, but I think Tas is touching on the meditative state of mind, where there's a stage in meditation.
Isn't that
what you're touching on?
Not quite, because in consciousness, like it, our consciousness is kind of like a string. So basically, when it happens, like you proceed to another consciousness. That's why when there's a joy, and then the next moment there's equanimity, but the two moments doesn't occur together. Does that make sense? Not really.
It makes sense, but I think you can only see that when you're meditating. So,
true, yeah, that's
so that's why there's a path, stages of meditation also touch on that, meaning that before you get to the level of equanimity, you will have piti or joy arises first, and then sukha is happiness, and then later on, in the later state, where you get upeka. Upeka is mainly when you're already in the absorption level, where you already, the consciousness has already been in the mind completely. So it's a bit deeper. So that's why, I think that's why you're saying that the consciousness is different. So it's a different kind of feeling or experiences.
Yeah, yeah. So when the consciousness flow from one state to another, it doesn't really share the same room. Mm-hmm. I'm not too sure.
Yeah.
It's like oil
it's a different
and water
state.
Really mix together. Yeah,
it's a different state.
So when there's joy arises, there's no equanimity, but then when there's equanimity, there's no joy. But at the same time, it can happen really quickly. Like, at one moment you have joy, and then the next moment you have equanimity. It can happen in like, in a minute a second. Yeah.
So we can actually experience it days and less you actually meditate.
Say it again.
I get it. So this upeka thing, you can't really experience it unless you meditate it.
No.
Or you can actually find it on the daily life as well.
I think it's up to the interpretation. How I interpreted it, in a mundane level, I think it's a different depth of equanimity. So the equanimity, of course, you can still feel it when you're not meditating. But if you meditate in a deeper state, the depth of it can be more profound. Similarly, when you're concentrating, when you're awake, and when you're meditation, it's a different depth of concentration as well. So I think it's just a difference in depth, but the quality of the feeling, probably you can, of course you can.
I should have got
that. Sorry, you want to ask a question?
It's just, does equanimity relates to having no expectation in a way? You don't really expect when you help someone, it's going to be better, so you're more at ease with the result and condition.
Yes, yes, you're right. Like, to have equanimity, you won't be able to have any expectation. So once you let go of the expectation, generally you will feel peaceful anyway. You'll feel at ease. So in a way, yes, you're right. Because the expectation itself is wanting. It's a sense of wanting. When you want something, peace wouldn't be there. You can only be at peace at something when you completely let go of your wanting. Now, wanting is another way of control in the mind. So when the mind tend to have a sense of control, and one way it manifests is as a sense of wanting. Basically, it's your ego, the sense of self.
This is not going to start off as a question, but it will eventually become a question, so just bear with me. So I have a question. So bringing it back to the topic of the love and relationships part of the talk. So the way that I sometimes explain like the one is like, if you were walking through an orchard, but it was a one-way path, and on the way you can pick one apple. So like as you go, you might see like a big apple, and then you might think that, oh, should I pick this one? But once you pick one, you can't just let it go and like pick another one when you see it. So the way I relate this to like relationships and the one is like, how do you know that this is the best that you will get? And like, if it is or if it's not, like, how do you sort of reconcile that then?
Good question. I think it's a very subjective question. Everybody will think differently, and I will think differently from most people in the room probably. But how I see it is that this is what I heard from people, right? People say sometimes you just know instinctively if this person is right for you or not. I agree to that notion to some degree, but I also think that we make the other person the one. Like we sometimes have that sort of thinking in our mind that he is the one, but it's just a makeup in the mind. Like, is there a real the one or not? Who knows? But a lot of times it's our own interpretation of the experience or the people that we make the other person be one. When things happen in a way that we don't want it to happen, the one can be the opposite, you know? It can be the opposite altogether. So the real the one probably is just a concept in the mind. I don't deny some people will be a better person for you and the other person might not, because this person might not be as having a lot of good qualities in them and could create more harm in your life. I don't deny there's that sort of dynamics in relationship, but there are also on the opposite will be true. There will be some people that come to your life and you will make your life a lot easier, a lot better, because this person can teach you a lot. This person can bring more wisdom, more kindness into your life, that you become a better person as a result. And if you like becoming this kind of quality or this kind of person because of this person bring that quality into your life, you probably will make this person to become your one, because you see the benefit that you get by having this person in your life. Therefore, you create the idea in your mind to thinking that he is the one. But then if the other person creates more harm to you, some people can be out of delusion thinking that he's also the one. Yet their friends and everybody else say that you are not good together. Yet they're adamant that he is the one or she is the one. So is it true or not? I don't know. How I see it is we make the other person the one. There's no real the one. There will be a good person that will bring goodness to your life. There will be a bad person. When I say good or bad, it's just categorizing, make it easier. Doesn't mean that they are good, doesn't mean that they are bad. But the mixture, you and the other person, if it's one A plus B equals to bad, then maybe it's not a good relationship. But if A plus B equals to better condition, better understanding, better growth, then yeah, probably it's a good relationship, something that you want to explore more. That's how I see it. You can disagree with me.
Okay, in that case, I have another question.
Yeah, go for it.
Sorry, it seems like I'm having a lot of relationship questions.
I'm fine.
Okay, my question is, this might not be related to me, by the way.
Don't worry. No judgment.
My question is, so this relates to relationships and attachment. So how do you have that balance of being in a relationship but not getting too attached?
Can you? In reality, I think as long as we are not enlightened, we will always have the attachment. The only way out not to have the attachment is to be enlightened. That's short answer, but long answer, of course, we can always learn to have less attachment. We might want to even transform our attachment to a better attachment. I don't like the word better attachment, essentially because attachment will cause pain anyway. But better attachment, in a way, you probably want to have more altruistic or more purposeful intention behind the relationship, right? So what I'm trying to say here, for example, I'll give you an example. If if your intention be with this person is to be better person together as a result of the relationship, then I think it's a better relationship than as another, as the opposite of I want to be with this person because it makes me feel happy. That's a more selfish sort of intention. But more less selfish intention is to support the other person, to grow together, to become a better person, or to, you know, to learn to be a better human being together. That's a better, it's a better, less selfish kind of desire to be with somebody than just want to make me feel happy. Oh, I'm with this person because I'm happy. I don't care about anything else in the world. I'm happy. That's all what matters. But if that's your real, if that's the reason you become in, you be with the other person, you're bound to be more pain, to have more pain, because your intention is to make me happy. Right? It's all about me. If it's all about me, it will be more pain. But it's about us. It's about the better of more people, then probably less. But in reality, probably you won't be able to get rid of completely the attachment unless you are enlightened. I mean, just be pragmatic and be realistic. That's how it is. You might have less attachment, but essentially still attachment. But it's a choice. It's a choice. And I hope we all make wiser choice.
I think that relates to whether, when you're entering a relationship, whether you're a full person, as I mean, like, have you found yourself first, but not trying to find yourself in others? I think that's the key point.
Not to make the other person to feel, to make you feel happy.
Yeah.
Can you repeat that phrase? It was a really nice phrase. Can you repeat it?
Now I don't.
To find yourself.
Yeah.
That's a good one. That's true. A lot of people fill the void in their heart by having another person. It's another psychology lesson on that one. But yeah, it's not uncommon for people to enter a relationship because they want the other person to fill the void. Essentially, everybody wants to be loved and to love. Because human beings are social beings. We are conditioned to have connection with another person, whether it's a family connection, whether it's a friendship connection, whether it's a romantic connection. We are bounded, we are wired, we are so conditioned in the body, in the mind, to have that connection. In fact, the study shows that the key to happiness is having good relationship, having that beautiful connection with the people that know, that is the key to their happiness. So we are bound, we are wired in a way to relate to other human beings. So if you deny that, it also causes pain. If you deny and isolate yourself, it's also not going to be helpful for your well-being, because your makeup, your genetic makeup, your body makeup is the opposite. You need to be connected with another human being to feel happier. But the Buddha say there's even a better way out, is to practice the path. But to practice the path, if you notice, the practicing the path is also social in a way. You will need the interactions with other human beings to practice. For example, generosity. You need a giver and a recipient. You can't practice generosity without somebody who receives the gift or the generosity that you are providing. So there's always that human interactions in the practice as well. So you can't essentially cut yourself away from everybody. So it is part of life that you have to interact with people, you have to have relationships, but we can build better bridge among ourselves than burning bridges in a way, or building fences. We should build more bridges than fences. Because if you build your fences or your wall out, it's not going to be good for your well-being. It's hard to break the wall for some people. Some people are quite lucky that they can, but some people are quite unfortunately unlucky. They might be growing up in a condition that is not very happy, that makes them build the defense, self-defense, the wall, and therefore they can't be vulnerable with other people. It's all conditioning. But because it's conditioning, you can decondition me. That's the beauty of it, right? If it's an absolute thing, you can't change it. But because it's a conditioned, you can change it. It takes time, it takes effort, it takes patience, but it doesn't mean that you're doomed, because it can change. As long as you want to put the work, then it can change. Human psychology is very interesting. But then it gets more interesting when you understand yourself. More question?
Yes. So like, how do you relate like the Four Noble Truths with like parental love, like instead of like the relationship, like the romantic relationship? So like, how do you relate it to parental love?
You're talking as a child or as a parent?
Like parents, like how, like the love between a child and a parent.
Same thing. You can practice all the metta, karuna, mudita, and upekkha between the parents and the children. What is quite common between parents and children is the expectations. So probably the way you want to look at is what sort of expectations you have with your parents, and what sort of expectations parents have for their children. Because that is the common cause for friction in the family. Because family bond is quite strong usually. No matter what happens, usually kids will always go back to their parents. No matter how much the parents have hurt them, kids will always welcome their parents. Likewise, no matter how much their children has hurt them, the parents will always have the open arms and welcome their children. The bond between parents and children essentially is quite strong in that sense. But what causes a lot of problem is actually our expectations. We expect, and what we expect might not be delivered. And when the expectation is not delivered, that can cause a lot of problem. So to overcome that is we can practice a lot of metta. Because the quality of metta is a quality of full acceptance. Like whether it's a bad apple, good apple, rotten apple, you accept it fully as it is. And that is the hardest part, I think, to fully accept somebody else, let alone one person. That's why the practice starts with oneself. Because if you can accept yourself as who you are completely, without any rejection whatsoever, even a tiny rejection, there's no rejection whatever of your good or bad quality in yourself, then you can accept the other person completely. A lot of times how we react, how we behave, is a self-reflection of how we treat ourselves. So if you can accept yourself fully, completely, it's easier to accept the other person. It doesn't make it easier in a way that you might not feel anything, but at least it helps in a way to have a better connection and better relationship with them. Because when you expect the other person to be different than what you want them to be, or to be different from who they are, they won't be liking it. You will know when somebody expects you to behave in a way that you don't like. You will feel it, and because of that you don't like it, so it will cause conflict. So it's easier if it's it becomes more peaceful if we can accept things as what it is, I think. And also I'm not a parent, but I've seen and I've known a lot of parents. Parents naturally are attached to their kids. That's a natural thing. They like it or not, they will always have that innate attachment to their children. Partly survival, because without the attachment, the children wouldn't survive. Partly also, it's just conditioning, I suppose, because you have given so much to this being for so many years. So in a way, has become part of you. When something has become part of you, it's also an attachment. But I guess it's a beautiful attachment, because although it's an attachment, but because of that strong attachment, they'll always welcome you, their kids. No matter what their kids have done, they'll always welcome them, because it's already becoming part of them. That's why it's beautiful. So I think if you want to rate attachment sort of kind of love, I'll put parenthood at the top, because it's, I guess, overall, it's the most selfless kind of love in a way. They give a lot. They give. Of course, I'm not talking all parents will be like that, but majority of parents will be like that. Parents, there are some bad parents, I don't deny that. Unfortunately, they could be dealing with a lot of drugs, addiction, that they don't have good quality of mind to be able to look after their children very well. Those parents probably are not good parents. But majority of parents are beautiful. They have beautiful hearts.
Going on to what you said about like not trying, like accepting people as they are and not trying to change them. But what if you're trying to change them for the better? Like say they are very lazy and you want to make them study or something like that. Like, would that still contradict the idea of accepting people as they are?
Why do you want to change them?
Because they could be better people. Not just from your point of view, but just from a general point of view.
So if they don't change, how do you respond?
Depends.
I think it's worth questioning ourselves why we want to do it. See first why you want to do that. I don't say that it's a wrong thing or the right thing to do, but what is the intention behind us wanting to change the other person? Is it because of selfish reason, because that's what I prefer? Or is it because for the better for the better benefit for the other person? What is it? Because sometimes, to your surprise, it could be out of selfish intention, that you prefer this person to become like this. But it could be also coming from altruistic intention, where you want this other person to perform better, to lead a better life. Can be, which is fine. Once we know our intention, then we can then think of what's the best action to do that. Because if we act from worst intention or bad intention, selfish intention, no matter what, the process will be more painful. But if you're coming from a good place, usually the process is more smooth in a way. I'm not saying that the change will happen smoothly. What I'm saying is that how you feel about it throughout the process is more smooth in a way. You have less pain, if that makes sense. You have less frustration.
Okay, so because I teach students like for HSC and stuff, and sometimes they don't do their work. And from my perspective, I'm trying to make them do work because that ensures them a better future. It doesn't really affect me. But when they don't do their work, like I get really frustrated because I feel like they could be doing so much better, but they don't want to put the effort in. So, like, is that because I'm being selfish or because it doesn't feel smooth in that sense?
It's fine. I mean, you will know for sure what it is, but from what I heard, you probably want the best for them. But maybe that's not the effective way of doing things. So the question is not so much about that then. The question will be, what will be more effective way of encouraging them? Okay, another point. With those sort of situation, the most effective thing that I find is to motivate. Not to make them do something, but motivate them to want to do it. So if you change the way you do it, you probably be able to encourage them and motivate them, inspire them to do what you think is best for them. If you have that sort of attitude, probably it's less frustrating for you because it's not coming that I want you to do this, but rather than I'm encouraging you to do this. It's now up to you whether you want to do it or not. But I'm encouraging you, so your focus is more so much about how do I motivate them? It's not easy, yeah? It's not easy. But it's okay. You're doing, just keep doing the best you can. And you know what? Sometimes we don't know whether it's a good thing or bad thing for them. Good or bad, who really knows? Do we have a crystal ball to be able to tell us that this is going to be good for their future? Never know. So many dropouts, students are doing much better than people who graduate. Who knows? We don't know. So sometimes reminding ourselves, that helps us to overcome our frustration. Because our frustration comes from wanting something to happen, but it doesn't happen. So to help us let go of that, just to remind ourselves again and again that we don't know. We don't know what the future is going to be like. I think this is going to be good for their future, but who knows? Who knows?
Yeah, but I guess the flip side of that is just me being too, like, it's the complete opposite. So instead of me wanting them to, like, do work, it's me, like, oh, you guys can do this if you want to, and me just not caring. Because then I feel like then I'm not doing my responsibility as the teacher. And that's, like, the whole other extreme then. Yeah.
It's good that you're aware of it. It's okay. It's okay. It's good that you're aware of it. And then if you want to change, then you change. If you don't want to change, then it's fine. But since you're aware of it and you don't like it, then I think that you want to change. Which is fine. Yeah. More question? What time do we finish? Still more time? If you want to finish early, I'm fine too. No more question? No?
So relating to, like, not wanting something or not expecting to have something, how does that, in, like, a pragmatic way, how do I put this, like, how to still have, you know, goals and dreams and ambitions, but also having no expectation or no wanting something, you know? Because you, in life, you should try to move forward, but then if you're at ease with what's currently, what the current condition, then how can you expect to move forward? Because it doesn't really matter.
I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
This is how I see it. When you want to travel, you need to know your direction, don't you? You need to know whether you're going north, south, west, or east. But the road to get to the destination, there are so many ways. I'm trying to piece all my thoughts together. But but to, okay, expectations or wanting is another thing. Goal and directions is another thing. In life, I agree, we have to have direction. Otherwise, we will be lost. You don't know which direction to take, whether north, east, south, west. And you will be easily be swayed by the wind. If the wind blows to the west, you'll go to the west. If the wind blows to the north, you'll go to the north. So it's important in life to have that roadmap in a way. And what I see important as a roadmap in life is your principle in life, your fundamental principle. That is, that somehow ties to the core value that you have in life. So it could be, for me, is my practice, Buddhist practice is my core principle in my life. So that will always be my first guidance in whatever decision that I'm going to make in my life. It has to be in line with what I value, which in this instance is my Buddhist value. So whether it's not harming anyone, whether it's harming anyone, or whether it's it brings benefit to more people or not. So that is my fundamental core in my life. Another one is also direction in a way. Like for example, I need to know whether I want to become a doctor, whether I want to become a lawyer, whether I want to become a teacher. Because if I know if I want to become a doctor, then I need to plan that I need to study to get a degree to become a doctor. Otherwise, I wouldn't become a doctor. So it's quite important. That's a worldly goal, in a way, that we need to have. But to get there, we will... like. If you go on a road, sometimes you will have traffic jam. Sometimes you will have a smooth going road. Sometimes you have to pay tolls. Sometimes you don't have to. So the journey in itself matters. So whether you will feel frustrated when you meet the traffic jam, right, or not. That's where I see where you can apply the notion of having the expectations. When you study to become a doctor, you probably have expectations to finish the degree. Let's say we want to have an expectation to finish the degree, but sometimes we might not. Okay, rewind a little bit. What I'm trying to say is that we do the best as we can at particular moment to meet our goal. In this instance, if you want to become a doctor, then we do our best. To become a good doctor, you need to know your stuff, right? You need to memorize stuff. You need to understand how the body works. You need to understand a lot of the body. Therefore, you do your best to do that. But the goal, but the expectation is... you try to minimize as much as possible of the expectation to be something or somebody that you have in mind. Let's say you have an idea what a good doctor, an ideal doctor should be like. You have that picture in your mind, so you want to become like that. But as you know, sometimes it's not quite straightforward. You might not be able to meet that. So probably... that's not gonna be helpful. You can have an ambition to become one, but you don't cling to that. That's where I'm coming from. Like you don't cling to the outcome, but rather you try your best to meet your expectation or to meet your ambition. But if it happens, hooray. If it doesn't happen, it's okay. But doesn't mean that you don't aspire to reach it. You do. You put all the work, the hard work, the effort to do that, but if you don't get it, it's fine. What matters is the effort. Make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because without goal or ambitions, probably you won't reach anywhere. But to have too much of it also, you forgetting about what's important in life. So it's all about the balance. The balance of what is the right balance. You don't want to neglect important part of your life to just meet your goal and ambition, because essentially you have to leave them all behind when you pass away. Nothing can be taken with you when you leave this body. So you need to put your values in perspective, what matters the most. Because essentially, all this physical body, all these physical achievements are going to be left behind. So I will encourage you to stay in the process. So put more emphasis in how you go about it rather than the goal. But how you reach to the goal is more important than the goal itself. So whether you do it in a best possible way you can, and you do it in a gentle, kind way when you relate to people along the way, are you kind, or are you compassionate, or are you having all these good qualities with them or not? That's more important than reaching the goal itself, because it takes more time in the journey than having been in the destination. It's a good question. I also ask myself that. It's a good question.
To family love, I'm just wondering, because especially these small cases in Asian families where you have the older generation, let's say our parents are probably older, and then you have the now younger batch, probably are more people who also went overseas, are seeing more stuff, and it's understandable that they all wish for the others to be happy, but not wish for the others to be better. For example, the family will obviously wish for their son or daughters to be better, and then same with the son and daughter. So normally what I see in cases where, like, the mother and father, for example, would wish, I don't know, like their son or daughters, you know, to study, go to get good grades, go to uni, and then, you know, you should be doing engineer, doctor, blah blah blah, all the Asian subjects, and then go get a good job, and then, you know, get a good life, get married, yeah, earn money. But then there's also a lot right now, I'm not sure, maybe it's just that any of my circle of people that I've met, they are, it's like, because they've also see a different kind of life. Like, if you look at it right now, especially technology-based, the generation right now are more based on experiencing first instead of saving money first, compared to the older ones. And so sometimes because of this, like, there's different thinking in both of them, where the parents would want their children, you know, you should be doing this, you shouldn't go out and do like all this stuff. But then there's also the children who also still love the parents, but it's hard for them to also not communicate, but it's also like because of the different expectation. For example, their life would probably be, maybe they don't want to become a lawyer, doctor, or something, and do something, let's say, firefighter, policeman, or I don't know, something which is probably different than what normally Asian parents would expect. So just looking at this, because because there's also a lot of people who probably also love their parents because the parents have given them a lot, but what kind of advice would be, I don't know, good? Because I'm pretty sure that a lot of people, because of the expectation from their parents, they will probably feel stressed. It doesn't feel as much of like the family love anymore, but then at the same time they do not want to disrespect and still want to love, but they are still feeling stressed on it. Like, it's such a complicated thing.
No, it's not uncommon though. It's quite common to happen in real life. And I don't have, unfortunately, I don't think I have a good answer to that question, because it's case by case most of the time. And also it depends on how well the communication between the parents and their children, and whether the parents have strong attachment to their own views, to what the children should be like, or should do. So it's a case by case thing. But I guess as a children to this sort of environment, we try not to feel frustrated in a way. We try to understand where they're coming from. So try to see from the other person where they're coming from, why they want me to do this, so that it helps us to overcome the difference, if that makes sense. So if you understand where your parents coming from, then you probably don't react to it with anger compared to if you don't really understand. If you think like, my parents don't understand me, they don't know me, why on earth they want me to do this, means that they don't know me. But rather than having that kind of attitude, you might want to try to see, why do they want me to do this? And probably by knowing that, you could have better effective communication with them. Because if you know that, okay, they want me to do this and that because they believe if I do this and that, it will be good for me. Then you tap the communication that way to say, look, mom, dad, I think you're doing this to me because you want the best for me. However, I think what's best for me is so and so. You know what I mean? Like, the way you approach things could be different. Although the goal is to overcome the challenge, but the same goal, but if you approach it in a different way, the outcome might be different. So it's, I don't know. So I guess the key to it is communication. Try to bridge the difference between the expectations. There's no right or wrong. The parents could be wrong. The parents could be right. Who knows? But I guess most parents want the best for their kids. And that's why they think like that. But unfortunately, sometimes maybe what they think is not the best, the real best for their kids. Because it could bring more harm by imposing that than by letting the kids go in a way. So yeah. Unfortunately, it's just not an easy way out. I wish there's a button, huh? You can push, tick, and things just solve. But that's not how it is in life. That's why life is suffering, huh? No, just joking. But yeah, so if you can't find reconciliation out of that, then probably you have to accept it. Either you want to follow the parents' wish or not, whatever decision that you make, then you have to accept it. And if your parents are not like that, then just be grateful, because that's very rare to have parents who are 100% trusting you for your life. Very rare. So if you do have parents like them, you're one in a million. So you have to appreciate them, because it's not easy for parents to do that. They bring up another being from baby till they grow up. If they can let you go, they have a big heart.